I come from a country where environmental advocates are just shot in the face. So I'm kind of okay. I'm like, hey, you know, we're in the U.S. You probably won't kill me. And that feels pretty good. So I think we should all feel a little sigh of relief. We're as bad as it's getting in this country. We need to always remember how much worse it could be. We are not there, you know, so let's not feed into this fear thing that I see happening of like, this is the worst. We're already in fascism. It's already Nazi. I'm like, no, it's actually not there yet. And saying that it is, right, and contributing to a little bit of all that trauma that gets, you know, echo chambered around us is not helping. How is it that we're sharing the light with each other of what's possible, of what's not happening here, of the atrocities that do happen to advocates in other countries? Because I would venture to say most people, including myself, hey, I was raised in this country. I came here when I was two. So I look at my mom's degree of toughness and I'm like, as tough as I seem, I'm pretty soft. And so I think it's really important to keep that perspective, that global perspective, because we owe a responsibility to the people in other countries to make sure it does not get that bad here, to make sure that in the belly of the beast, there is resistance and that we're not going passively into the night. And that's where I believe a lot of the folks in this room, you have such an important piece to play. Because when Trump started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. To be part of, first off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. Environmental justice, when I started, was not popular, okay? Even with the EJ law, I had Greens being the mainstream organizations, and I'll name them, right? They can call me. They know my number. National Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, even my friends, Earth Justice. Like, a lot of them didn't fight with us because they didn't think it was politically feasible. A lot of the mainstream organizations were willing to sacrifice communities at the local level for the greater good. And we're never going to get anywhere when you start talking about sacrificing real people for this greater imaginary tomorrow, right? With the Enviros, we had a fight over carbon credit, creating like a crazy Wall Street of pollution that somehow was going to incentivize the people that created a problem. That's how I would explain tax credits, you know? They're like, no, it's a necessity. Bloomberg said so. Cool. But I would say in my neighborhood, those types of things never work. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us. Because in our neighborhood, it's very clear the industry wants to kill us, right? They put toxic chemicals, they put arsenic, mercury, dioxin into the air. That means they don't care about the kids who have to grow up in that neighborhood. That is not negotiable for me. So when it came to the Transportation Climate Initiative, another brilliant idea by mainstream environmental organizations, that they were going to do some like fancy formulas, control the price of gas, and don't worry, somehow industry wasn't just going to pass that on to the consumer, which I was like, that ends up being a gas tax. Like, you just gave me a whole presentation and I just heard gas tax. And in our neighborhood in Newark, right? Newark, so y'all know, it used to be white. Once upon a time, it used to be a white affluent neighborhood. It was going to rival New York City, right? Because it has a great placement. It's on the bay and it has a lot of access in and out. It didn't end up being that. It ended up being like second city in that area. But industry started landing there because of the river and that access. About 50 years ago, there was what we call the Newark Rebellion. Outsiders call it the Newark Riots, right? It was the time of another racial reckoning in this country. Because I would say we go on the merry-go-round on racial reckonings. And I knew in the uprisings after George Floyd that we were on one part of the racial merry-go-round and that it would come to this moment again. So the Newark Rebellion caused a lot of white flight from our neighborhood, and that caused a lot of disinvestment. And so in our neighborhood, there is a tension of like people need jobs. Because people do, I would say that no matter what, you know, your background is, race, gender, nationality, sexual orientation, people want to be able to support their families, right? We need to erase the idea of freeloaders. And if there are such a small percentage, don't stress about it. You know, like, people want to do good. I do fundamentally believe in the good of all people. And so if you believe in the good of all people, you have to acknowledge that there is a tension between economic development sometimes and then unfortunate, there are resources around them. And so it has led our city to be in a precarious situation, to have to consider industry in exchange for jobs. And actually, that's often how we get held hostage, is by industries promising jobs. What's great for me is that a garbage incinerator doesn't have a lot of jobs. I can prove that that power plant is only going to have a couple of engineers, especially now technology runs it. But if we don't acknowledge that tension, if we minimize it, we isolate a big segment of the people that we're hoping to serve in a community. Because everyone wants a walkable downtown with flourishing business and things to happen. With the economic thing, we did manage in the rulemaking to make sure that economic was not a compelling public interest. Because, you know, obviously industry wanted there to be exceptions for a compelling public interest. And we're like, yeah, compelling public interest means it benefits the host community. So if it's going to be a sludge plant, it better only deal with our sludge, not 12 states. So that was a pretty good thing about the law. And in case you're wondering why the fourth power plant, it came in before the law. It's a power plant I've been fighting since 2014. So not bad that we dragged it out for about 10 years. They just got approved, and we'll see if their financing holds true, because all of their plans are from more than a decade ago. The reason for that power plant, actually, and it's something everybody needs to watch out for, is because the sewage waste treatment facility, when we had Superstorm Sandy, right, which, yeah, hurricanes in the Northeast should not be that big of a deal, but, and it wasn't a hurricane, it was just a superstorm, but because our infrastructure is not set up, that we're not Florida, we're not set up to manage all that amount of water. It put the facility out for a couple of days. And as you can imagine, having raw sewage in the river is bad. It's also the reason our governor said we need a power plant, which again, I had to fight a lot of like suburban environmentalists about the fact that I don't care if there's sludge once in the bay, because a power plant is going to be toxic to the neighborhood every single day as long as it exists. And if you build it, they will use it. There's no like, oh, this is just for backup situations. The original permit was for, you know, for them to subsidize their energy cost and they would save some money. Anyway, lost that fight. Really sad. And actually, it's one of my rules. Don't be a loser, okay? Because with our fights, sometimes we pick the big fights. And I've been hanging out with a lot of people. And so, yeah, we all want to fight racism. Can we have a campaign realistically to end racism today? Probably not. We need to figure out what's the one thing we can do. Is it achievable? And if you're going to fail, because there is a space for failure, but it needs to be meaningful failure. It can't just be your own ego, because I have been across the table of wonderful lawyers who let their ego kind of run and say, I'm going to make this campaign. It's going to set precedent. Even though it's going to set precedent and puts the community through a lot of emotional back and forth, right? It's really hard to sit there and witness failure after failure. For communities to trust us, we can't be losers, because no one wants to hang out with losers, right? I would say that's a pretty good thing that's shared across people, that if you feel like someone is constantly failing, maybe you don't want to associate with them. So how do we pick fights that invigorate our base, that invigorate our communities? If they're going to fight, it's a wonderful, spectacular fight. Like Stop Newark, you know, with the fourth power plant, we had a lot of fun with the governor, who was originally just going to push it through. That was about 4 years ago, and he was going to push it through right after Christmas because he thought we weren't paying attention. Luckily for me, we don't really, you know, family time. Who needs that? My family totally understands why I need to be harassing the governor of our state over the Christmas weekend. So we were able to get the governor to back off and again, delay it for 4 years. I think of every 4 years as a generation. When a kid grows up breathing in that air, even if everything else works out in their life, they're going to be scarred by the air that they're breathing in when they were a little kid, because little kids breathe faster than us. So they are more vulnerable to air pollution. you know, I've been doing this organizing thing since I was a kid. I was raised by a woman from Central America who wanted me to someday go back home and lead the revolution. That did not happen, obviously. I'm here in Eugene, Oregon, far, hopefully not too far from the revolution. But, you know, I did get rooted in place. And actually, I didn't even take to environmental justice at first because I didn't see it as, I didn't know that there was such a thing as environmental justice. Okay, let me be clear. I knew about the environmental stuff. And even though I grew up with a deep, like, reverence for the natural world based on, my cultural beliefs, I still thought it was kind of weird the way environmentalism happened, right? Of this sacred place of conserve it. Don't, like, interact with it. Like, I was like, that, I don't relate to that. That's weird that nature is somehow separate from us, not something we are of. I'm like, we are part of the natural world, right? So already there, environmentalism felt not for me. I thought it was a soft issue or maybe nice to get to issue because in the community I grew up in, people were getting shot and evicted, right? There was police brutality that I could witness. I grew up being scared about my family crossing the border. And I want to be clear about this. People, at least, you know, a lot of the people I saw immigrating, they weren't really looking for a better life. It was American imperialism that was ruining our countries. Because as far as I think about, when I think about my country, it's paradise, right? It's people go vacation in a lot of our countries. And but they get access, you know, the tourists from America or Europe, they get access to parts of our country that we don't, right? We don't have the resources. Resources are extracted by multinational corporations. And then we're left to have to figure this out. So of course we come to the source of where, if you follow people, you're following the money back to the U.S. It was really tied to my journey into environmental justice. I thought all those issues came first. I didn't realize that there was a movement that cared about all the issues together, that saw us as holistic human beings. And that is what environmental justice is supposed to do. Now, under Biden, it became really weird because all of a sudden environmental justice was on the national, like at the forefront of national politics. And I was really proud that the president had even spoken about our movement, that we were able to get the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council off the ground, right? So that council, I guess there used to be the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, NEJAC, and that only advised EPA. But that's actually a siloing of environmental justice when environmental justice is supposed to be about the other departments too. I was so excited to think that Department of Transportation, Department of Labor, Department of Justice, that they all had to consider their role. I mean, you think about the toxic legacy left behind by military sites. You think about how, I mean, transportation is at the heart of civil rights, right? Of people being segregated from on a bus. So it was exciting to be able to have all departments have a holistic vision. I loved the whole of government approach, right? I never thought that I would have so much excitement around the presidency of a, you know, pretty old white guy, but his, you know, his approach to environmental justice, his administration, because that's the thing too. I don't believe in kings. It wasn't Joe Biden. It was all the staff around him, right? It was all everybody that got to serve in that administration. That was what was powerful about the last 4 years. It was the exciting voices in government that were not really elevated or been given that freedom before. And I would say there was more diversity and excitement in Biden's administration than even in Obama, right? More uplifting of regular communities, because that's what Justice 40 was. It was a place for even neglected communities, you know, because I got asked by reporters a lot, what about poor white communities? I'm like, poor white folks have always been with us in the environmental justice movement. Because again, the environmental movement doesn't serve them either. They get left out or sacrificed or seen as backwards because they're attached to coal. But you're attached to the livelihood of your neighborhood. And so if you're trying to do good work, you have to know the heart of any community. Learn it and learn it well. Don't disrespect it, even if it might need a change, right? We need to really meet people where they're at. And so being elevated to the WEJAC was incredibly exciting, right? To think that someone from such a neighborhood-based perspective could have something to offer in a national forum across the country. And I think that's the solutions are actually from the very bottom all the way up. We have to go bottom up. It's never going to be top down. So we can't get too hung up on who is the front person. We have to always look, and any politician, who's the team around them? And we're seeing the disaster team around the current administration, right? But who's the team around any of the leaders that we're going to put forth? Because I'm excited that, you know, hopefully I'll be an attendee here in 4 years, and we'll be having a completely different conversation about how excited we are to go fight for the person, not how we're going to go fight against Trump. Because I think that's always been the problem. I don't want to fight against Trump. I don't want to fight against Trump's followers. I want to fight for somebody. Somebody that's exciting and inspirational, right? Who tells things like it is. We do need to take some of that, not tries to sugarcoat things. And while I was on the WEJAC, I advocated for humble government, because even in the Inflation Reduction Act, there was a lot of money, more than for environmental justice, on this process called carbon management, right? Which is also about carbon sequestration, about hydrogen, right? And so carbon sequestration is, you know, sucking carbon out of the air, and then we're going to let technology somehow put it into the ground, and then we're going to hope it works. And I'm sure that there's a lot of scientists. I mean, I was briefed by a lot of scientists that were like, this is a great thing. And don't worry, we've accounted for everything. I was part of a panel where the biggest consideration was not to prevent accidents. Because my thing is, sure, maybe CCS works someday, but we don't have that type of time, right? For something, a technology that is unproven, a technology that would be experimental. And guess where it would be happening? Our black and brown communities that are host to big oil and gas, right? That's where you're going to be sucking up the carbon. Then I found out that you suck up the carbon, that's EPA's problem. But then when the carbon is in the pipe, that's Department of Transportation. And then that's PHMSA. And I was like, oh no, like there's like 10 different regulatory agencies for a community to have to navigate their way through to hope that things are okay. And there was actually examples like in Kalamazoo where the pipeline leaked. And then there were people who passed out because carbon is an asphyxiant, right? It makes you pass out. I got to read firsthand accounts from responders who showed up to a scene and the cars were turned off because the air to the engine stopped and the people in it were passed out. I was like, that's the beginning of a horror movie, isn't it? And of course, it would be a horror movie bought on by human arrogance of saying, we got this. I have gotten to hang out with very powerful people who, you know, at our foundations. They were just like, that's human error. Every, you know, nuclear disaster has just been human error. And I was like, interesting. They're like, if only we had a better process. And I'm like, shouldn't you build in human error? Because human error will always happen. And so maybe keep those fixes apart. During the WEJAC process, we did have two series of recommendations on carbon management, against carbon management. Very clear, carbon management is not the way to go. We're wasting our time if we think we're going to solve climate change through, you know, a complete belief in an experimental technology. Technology is not going to save us. What's going to save us is relationships to each other, of making sure that we're able to build a successful future, right? That we stop picking fights that don't make sense because of our own egos, and we pick fights that make sense to the people, that the people are behind you, that they're invested. Because when they're invested, and fighting should be fun, you know, because what else is there to lose? The other side wants to kill us. I think they've made that very clear. So if we're going to fight back, we should fight back like people who have nothing to lose. We can't hang out at home waiting for them to come for us. We need to be with each other, making this as fun as possible. And actually, that's what I was able to do. I got this wonderful opportunity a few years ago through the Tishman Center. The Tishman Center had a fellowship for environmental justice leaders. And what was radical about it was there was no agenda. You know, it was, first off, we were able to be with other leaders, which, you know, I was running the environmental justice work at Ironbound at the time. And I realized that I never had time to even develop the relationships with my own colleagues. They were happening a little bit quickly at lunch or a little bit at the bar if you had enough stamina to stick around. But the agenda was packed. It was packed with workshops and brainstorms and whatever. That is not the best use of time, people, okay? Especially when you're not letting people be organic. So at the Tishman Fellowship, I came in with other leaders like Rawa from Push Buffalo, Dwayne Tyndall from ACE Alternatives for Community Environment in Boston, and Mia Yoshitami from APEN, which is Asian Pacific for Environmental Network. Thank you. I would say all of us are from different corners, really holding our own and having legacy fights. We were able to just be together, and we're given space to like have our own agenda, because leaders are often just brought into the room so that other people can pick their brains, right? Sometimes people offer me payment to come and just share whatever I got, but the relationship stays transactional, right? It doesn't become a transformative relationship about how we actually building a relationship that goes beyond this work. Because nothing about what any of you in this room want to do is could be called a job. You're not deciding to become accountants, okay? You're deciding to change the world, right? Because policy is about making the world in your image, in the image of the community and the values that you see. So we need to make sure that the people we're changing policy with, that we actually know them as human beings. We know what are their values, and we are building with people we trust and feel good about, right? Because if you do lose, you want to be with people you trust and you feel good about. And when you win, you want to celebrate with people that you feel good and you trust. And now more than ever, we're going to need those bonds that hold us together, right? Because all this terror and fear on different attacks, because they've got us segmented into different parts of our identity, right? Into our sexual orientation or our nationality. And then we're here having conversations about language when we need to be having more global, holistic conversations about, you know, what is the world that we want to see? And as government burns down, we need to think about how we're going to rebuild government, the government that we deserve as people. And the only way to know that is by listening, you know, to people and having conversations with as many people as possible, having rooms that are filled with people you've never seen before. And this might sound like I'm telling you to reach out to MAGA, okay? So let me be clear there. I think there's a bunch of people you're not talking to, okay? It's not just like people who are diehard MAGA, even though they might be in your family, and that's cool too. You can go try. But I would say that most of the time organizers focus on the extremes, and then we leave out all the people in the middle. And that's so many people in the middle. Organizer math is if you want 10 people in the room, you should have talked to 100. And that sounds crazy, but it's not. I mean, the best businesses have been built on robocalls to many people. And do you want to buy this? So you need to take the time to have all the people in the middle and talk to them. And that doesn't mean you move to the middle. I don't know if there's left and right, okay? We've allowed a lot of our beliefs to become radical. There's nothing radical about us, okay? We're not actually talking about, you know, taking all the land from rich people. Come on, I've not really heard that be the request. It's often like, I want clean water to drink. You know, we can't let that line of normalcy be moved so far away from us. We need to reclaim that it's normal to want clean air to breathe, you know, healthy food to eat and healthy land. So that's not crazy or radical. I think I'm kind of done.
You were just listening to Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March. Maria Lopez Nunez, an environmental justice organizer and eco-activist, is the deputy director of the Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark, New Jersey. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Tariq Ali, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arundhati Roy, and Winona LaDuke. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Maria Lopez Nunez on Environmental Justice, and for the Howard Zinn classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go, riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for people on the go.
I sent you to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to Anatomy of the Ear, an annual event where we play our favorite genres for you. Tune in to Anatomy of the Ear Friday through Sunday, 11 a.m. to 4 a.m. here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Regular programming will return Monday morning. For the next hour, prepare yourself for politics, tension, settled scores, Manichaean struggle. Prepare yourself for boss battles.
Welcome back. You just heard Deku from the Fight Crab OST with the theme Great Monster. Before that was a song that is credited with beginning jungle as a genre, if you can believe it, from the Wolverine Adamantium Rage Super Nintendo OST Tri-Fusion or Boss 2. Before that, something from Hylix. I had to do it to him. Hylix 2, the OST. An excerpt from Fancy Meat Computer, a boss theme. Prior to that, I had Battles with Wall Street. Now, that's not boss music, but doesn't it sound like it? Prior to that, Shin Megami Tensei 4 OST, Battle B2, the boss battle theme, when things get real in the world of Shin Megami Tensei. Now, we have something before that with its own wiki. Not its own game, unfortunately. The Tuba Brothers Battle Theme. Prior to that, it was Cadillacs and Dinosaurs OST, the beloved arcade version, Box 4 intro. Then we had Pixel Noir with Boss Fighting for Truth, the Maxo remix of that track. And of course, we had the Sin, the Slumbering Dragon, a very James Bond sounding theme from the Dark Souls 2 soundtrack. And we kicked things off with, from Solar Ash, the Forgotten Thresher. Anatomy of the Ear is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches, breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. Coming up next, it's Yik.